Welcome. A pleasure, Dr. Lakshin Prakasha.
Thank you. I'll just picking up on what you just said there. All the years that I lived in Canada, I was never in the Rockies. And all the years that I lived in North America, I was never at the Grand Canyon. And every Israeli that I knew has always been to the Rockies and to the Grand Canyon. And as soon as I made Aliyah, I found some way to get to the Rockies and to the Grand Canyon, because now I'm an Israeli, and an Israeli knows how to get to the Rockies and to the Grand Canyon.
Better do it fast. My time is running out.
Let me share my screen here with you. Rabbi Kelman was saying before that the Gemara teaches that there is the concept of the Zakein Mamre, of the teacher who is teaching false things, has often been misunderstood. Teachers are allowed to teach whatever they want, but they are not allowed to teach that is the way that somebody is supposed to be acting. They're not allowed to act against halacha. There's quite a bit of freedom of teaching of what you are allowed to teach, but not in rebelling against halacha. And I think that one of the people who really followed that teaching is Rashbam, who, as many of you know, is my favorite Torah commentator, because of his willingness to interpret against the grain, because of his willingness to offer new interpretations of texts, despite the fact that he was a very pious, frum person, one of the Baalei HaTosfot. There's no doubt about his commitment to the meticulous observance of halacha. In the session of classes, one of them dealt with Rashbam's surprising interpretation of Vayhi Erev Vayhi Boker Yom Echad. There was an evening and there was morning. A suggestion that if you're just reading the text of the that if you're just reading the text of the Torah, then the simple meaning of the first chapter of Genesis is that a day began in the morning and ended in the morning. Not suggesting that that is what the halacha is, but suggesting that that is how to understand the text. Rashbam, we're going to begin today's session by looking at Rashbam's other very famous, surprising, or perhaps even shocking comment, and that is his comment in his commentary on Exodus chapter 13. I think it's important to see the verse here in context before we see what Rashbam does with it. V'haya ki yivyacha Hashem el eretz haknani v'achiti v'amori v'achivi v'haivusi asher nishba l'avotecha latet lach eretz zavat chalav u'devash v'avadta et ha'avodah hazot v'chodesh hazeh. So when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, etc., you shall observe in this month, Nisan, in the spring, the following practice. What is the practice? Shivat yamim tochal matzot, uvayom ha-shvi'i chag l'Hashem. 7 days you shall eat matzah, unleavened bread. On the seventh day there's a festival for the Lord. Shivat yamim tochal matzot, uvayom ha-shvi'i chag l'Hashem. Matzot ye'achel et shivat hayamim, v'lo yera'e lecha chametz, v'lo yera'e lecha se'or, b'chol gvulecha. Throughout the 7 days, unleavened bread shall be eaten. No leavened bread shall be found with you. No leaven shall be found in all your territory. You shall explain to your son on that day, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I went free from Egypt. And now we come to the crucial. You have here the JPS translation of the verse, and this shall serve you, and this shall serve you as a sign on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead in order that the teaching of the Lord may be in your mouth, that with a mighty hand the Lord freed you from Egypt. And then verse 10, we'll get back to verse 9 and talk at length about verse 9. V'shamarta tachuka azot l'moada miyamim yamima. You should keep this institution at its set time from year to year. Now it seems that verses 5, 6, 7, 8, and probably 10 are talking about Passover, talking about Pesach. And it seems like verse 9 is talking about something else. And I'm sure that everybody here knows that the traditional understanding of verse 9 is that it is talking about tefillin, the sign on your hand, and the reminder on your forehead, the ot al yadcha, the zikaron bein einecha, is referring to tefillin, which religious Jewish men put on their arms and on their head above the spot that is between their eyes. It's hard to see how that understanding of verse 9 fits in all that smoothly with the context here. And Rashbam offers a totally different understanding of verse 9. He says, Lo'ot al yadcha, lefi omek pshuto, yeh lecha lezikaron tamid ke'ilu katuv al yadcha, ke'en sineni hachotam al libecha. A sign on your hand according to the profound, plain meaning of scripture, the deep pshat, the profound pshat. It will always be a reminder for you as if it were written on your hand, like the verse, let me be a seal on your heart. And what about bein einecha? Ke'en tachshit v'ravid zahav, like an ornament or a gold chain that is customarily put on the forehead for decoration. So what is Rashbam actually suggesting? What is the what is it that verse 9 is saying? It seems that Rashbam is saying that verse 9 means all these things that you do in order that this change of diet that you do, you're observing a Pesach and eating something totally different on Pesach, this will impress on you as if the fact were written on your arm and written on your head. It will impress upon you that ki biyad chazaka, that's what it will be. That's what will be impressed on you if you behave this way. And to make it totally clear, he's saying that this verse has nothing to do on the pshat level with tefillin. What the verse is saying that if you observe all these commandments about remembering Passover, remembering Pesach, this will impress it on your mind as if it were written on your heart. And when the lover says to the beloved in Song of Songs, let me be a seal on your heart, the lover does not mean I would like to be, put me physically onto your heart. What the lover means is, remember me always. I'd like to be in your heart. I'd like to be on your heart. I'd like you to remember me always. And we normally, when we talk about some kind of abstract idea like this, we try to look for something concrete that will describe it. And the memory of the lover, the thought of the lover will be as real as a locket or a seal that's on my heart, and as real as a gold chain that I put on my forehead for decoration. It'll be something that's surrounding me and that's affecting me at all times. So that's how Rashbam interprets these verses. Now, many of you will know that there are actually four different verses in the Torah that say something about a sign on your hand and an ornament or whatever, a frontlet in the old translation. I have no idea what a frontlet is, but the old translation used to say that it would be a frontlet between your eyes. There are four different verses about this in the Torah that use very similar phrases, and Rashbam comments only on the first of those four verses. What does he think about the other verses? We have no idea because he didn't comment about them. Some people have argued that because in the book of Deuteronomy and Devarim, when this idea appears, instead of saying, here it says, "V'haya lecha le'ot al yadcha," it should be a sign on your arm. That's one thing, but in Devarim, where it says "ukshartam leot al yadecha," you should tie them. That's the concrete action of tying makes it more likely that Rashbam understood that the pshat level of understanding here is that it is a reference to tefillin. This is possibly true. It is also, I think, definitely true. There's no doubt in my mind that Rashbam put on tefillin. People ask all the time, did Rashbam put on Rashi's tefillin, or did he put on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's brother. I don't know how to answer that, but I can't teach these texts without telling the old joke about the two yeshiva boys who meet many years after leaving the yeshiva, and one of them notices that the other one isn't wearing a kippah anymore. And he says to him, what happened to you? You're not wearing a kippah. And he says, well, people change. He said, but wait a second, do you still keep Shabbat? Do you still observe Shabbat? And he said, not really, a little, not so much. And he said to him, but of course you still keep kosher. He said, well, not the way I did back in yeshiva, but a little bit. And he said, tefillin, you still put on tefillin, don't you? And he said, I put on Rashbam's tefillin, meaning the metaphorical tefillin that Rashbam is describing here. He had to be a knowledgeable yeshiva boy in order to be able to come up with that punchline. There is no doubt, though, that Rashbam did put on tefillin. There is no doubt, as and Rabbi Kelman was talking before about what a rabbi is and is not allowed to teach, and before he gets defined as being a zaken mamrez, a teacher who's a rebellious teacher who's going to get a teaching like this is not considered the teaching of a zaken mamre. Although I will mention, interestingly, in the Gemara, they give the example that if a teacher says there is no tefillin in the Torah, the Gemara Sanhedrin, the Mishnah Sanhedrin, they say that if a teacher says there is no tefillin in the Torah, he is not defined as being a zaken mamre. And Rashi's explanation of that is because it's so obvious, zil kari be'rav hu. Everybody knows that there's tefillin in the Torah. So if a teacher gets up there and says there's no tefillin in the Torah, then they've said nothing. It'd be like saying the Torah doesn't say anything about pig, but it's obvious on the pshat level that the Torah does say they're not allowed to eat pig. So the example that the Gemara gave, according to Rashi's understanding of the Gemara and Sanhedrin, of something that is just so obvious, is the fact that tefillin are described in the Torah. And then along comes Rashi's grandson and says, you know what the real pshat interpretation of this phrase is? The real pshat interpretation of this phrase is the metaphorical understanding. And I used to always insist to my university students, I would not allow a university student to use the word literal when defining pshat. Because pshat, at least according to Rashbam, and I agree with Rashbam about this, Rashbam, pshat is the contextual explanation, the explanation that makes sense in the context. And sometimes the context calls for a metaphorical interpretation. And we're going to talk about that issue today. When does the context call for a non-literal interpretation? Rashbam looks at the context here, and I think that on the basis of the context, he came to the conclusion, oh, the context here does not call for a literal understanding. There literally does not have to be something on my arm and something on my head. What it is saying here is that my remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt should be so real as if it were on my arm and as if it were between my eyes on my forehead. So that's Rashbam. We don't know the precise year when he was born. We don't know the precise year that he died. He lived from more or less 1080 until more or less 1065, or maybe even as late as 1070. He may have lived a nice long life. Nor do we know for sure when it was that he wrote his commentary on the Torah. Many years ago, I wrote an article in which I went out on a limb and I suggested that Rashbam wrote his commentary on the Torah when he was in his 60s, after the year 1140. After I expressed this opinion, two other scholars here in Israel, Yonatan Jacobs and Itamar Kislev, wrote articles in which they agreed with me. Professor Avram Grossman is one of the biggest experts in the history of the medieval Jewish texts and rabbis. He actually disagrees with me, as in writing that he thinks that it was a little earlier. I'm still comfortable thinking that Rashbam wrote this commentary on the Torah in the early 1140s. Why am I going into this question? Because on the next two slides here, we are going to see what Ibn Ezra wrote about this same verse in two different commentaries of his. Abraham Ibn Ezra, who was a younger contemporary of Rashbam, somewhere 10 or 15 years younger than Rashbam. We saw him in an earlier session here attacking Rashbam about Vayivoker, about there was evening and there was morning. Ibn Ezra wrote two different commentaries on the book of Exodus, the shorter commentary and the longer commentary. The standard scholarly opinion is that the shorter commentary was written first, around the year 1142, and that the longer commentary was written about 11 years later in 1153. And I was just arguing that Rashbam was writing this comment in the beginning of the 1140s, in other words, around the year 1142, but in a different country. Ibn Ezra wrote his shorter commentary when he was living in Italy. He wrote his longer commentary later when he moved to northern France, when he was living where Rashbam had been living all of his life. So what we seem to have here is Rashbam and Ibn Ezra around the same time writing a commentary on this passage in the book of Exodus. And then 11 years later, Ibn Ezra revisiting the text. Now let's look at the difference between these two comments that Ibn Ezra has about this verse. Ibn Ezra writes, Yitachin al shnei perushim. There are two possible explanations. I could offer you two different explanations of this verse. Ha'echad, explanation number one, al derech koshrim al gargarotecha, Kotveim ale luach libecha. The verse should be understood like the verse, bind them round your neck, write them on the tablet of your heart. This is a reference to the words of wisdom, the words of Torah, if you wish, or words of other forms of wisdom that the author of Mishle is saying. This wisdom should be around your neck, and it should be written on the tablet of your heart. And of course, we all understand that that doesn't mean that there's something physical that you're supposed to do with these laws in writing them on your neck or writing them on the tablets of your heart. We all understand that this is a metaphor. And what it means is this wisdom should be around you all the time. It should be important to you. Ot, in this understanding, is a sign that this observance that you're doing of Pesach, remembering again the context there, you're observing Pesach, you're observing Passover, and that will serve to you as a sign, as a remembrance. This will cause you to remember something. Umahu shiyeh le'otu zikaron. And what is it that you're supposed to be remembering? What is that? What is it that will be a sign and a memory? That with a strong arm, God took you out of Egypt. But that's how to understand the verse. You and your children should remember that. So observe Pesach, observe all of these rules relating to leavened bread and unleavened bread, related to chametz and matzah, so that you will remember ki biyad chazaka hotzianu Hashem mimitzrayim, that God took us out of Egypt with a strong arm. So that's possibility number one, according to Ibn Ezra. And then Ibn Ezra says, "Va'perusha sheni liotol kemashmao lasot tefillin shel yad v'shel rosh." The second possibility is the literal explanation that the verse means to place tefillin on the head and on the arm. So he presents two possibilities, one of which he explains at some length. He goes through explaining it step by step. He offers another text from the book of Proverbs that seems to support that kind of understanding, that the metaphorical understanding that tying something, having something on your arm and on your head is not something physical that's being sought, but it's something abstract that's being sought. So that's the first interpretation. The second one is literally on your arm and literally on your head. And then he concludes, "Uba'avur she'etik he'etiku ched chazal." Since that second explanation is the one that the rabbis offered, la'atik in Ibn Ezra's Hebrew and in the Hebrew of many writers in the Middle Ages means to pass down a tradition. So the rabbis passed down the tradition of tefillin. He says, "Batel haperush harishon." The first explanation is canceled. Why? Ki ein alav edim ne'emanim kamo sheyesh laperush hasheni. It does not have as trustworthy witnesses testifying on its behalf as the second explanation has. So Chazal are to be trusted. Ibn Ezra often makes this point of trusting the traditions that were handed down by Chazal. Now, of course, Rashbam also trusted the traditions that were handed down by the rabbis. He didn't feel that meant that he had to say that's the pshat interpretation of the biblical verse. But Ibn Ezra says, when we've got two interpretations like this, we have these two possibilities, then I'm going to opt for the one that the rabbis that the rabbis mentioned. Why is he bothering? If he feels that the first interpretation is canceled, why is he writing an interpretation that he feels is canceled? I don't know why he does this. Is it possible that he's hinting that he thinks that there is something to this interpretation? Some people have suggested that Ibn Ezra was kind of sneaky like that. That he said, you know, I trust Chazal, I follow them, but I cancel out that first interpretation that I wrote. But he wrote that interpretation at some length. Is he trying to hint that he really does like that interpretation? I'm not convinced. It's hard to get inside of his mind and decide what is the reason why he wrote that interpretation. Anyways, that's what he wrote in 1142, which I am arguing is right around the same time that Rashbam is writing his commentary on Shmot, that in the early 1140s, Rashbam, living in northern France, was writing this commentary on Shmot. And in around 1142, Ibn Ezra, living in Italy, was writing this commentary. 11 years later, Ibn Ezra moves to northern France, before 11 years later. But by 11 years later, by 1153, when he's writing his longer commentary, he is living in northern France, and he is, as far as we can tell, living not that far from Rashbam. We have no evidence that the two of them actually ever met each other. There is one scholar who has argued that they must have met each other, but there really is no evidence. We do know that Ibn Ezra corresponded with Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam, but we have no evidence of direct contact between Ibn Ezra and Rashbam. But when we look at this commentary that was written in 1153, you gotta wonder about what happened between 1142 and 1153. So here is what Ibn Ezra writes in 1143. Yesh chokim al avoteinu hakadoshim. There are those who dispute with our holy forefathers. Sha'amar ki le'otu le'zikaron al derech ki lidyat chen him le'roshcha va'anakin le'gargarotecha. And they say that the sign here is to be understood like the verse in Proverbs. They are a garland for your head and pendants for your neck. The words of wisdom, words of Torah or of wisdom, however you want to understand that passage in Mishlei and Proverbs, those words are like a garland on your heart and pendants for your neck. But this doesn't, obviously this doesn't mean to put a garland on your head and put pendants around your neck. It's a metaphor. But people who say, to understand the verse here, "V'haya lecha le'ot al yadcha," in the same way as understanding the as understanding that verse in Proverbs, people who do that are disputing with our holy forefathers. That's chokim al avotenu hakadoshim. Just remember, in 1142, he wrote it. There are two possibilities. The tone, even for the content, hasn't really changed that much. In the end, he comes down on the tefillin side in both of these comments, but the tone has really changed. In 1142, he says, you know, there are two real possibilities about how to understand this verse. And then 1153, he says, there are some people who don't accept the authority of the holy ancient rabbis and say this. And now he explains why he is so upset. This is not proper methodology. In the beginning of that book, Proverbs, the book Mishlei, it is written, the Mishalim of Solomon. A mashal is a metaphor, an allegory. And so the book of Mishlei begins by announcing that it is a book of Mishalim, a book of metaphors, a book of allegories. But nothing that is written in the Torah should be seen as a mashal, God forbid. Ein katub ba-Torah shehu derech mashal, chalila. Rak hu kemashma'o. It is always to be understood literally. I told you before that I don't like translating the word pshat as literal, but the word mashma, mashma'o, that's a good word for literal. He's saying that the words of the Torah should be understood literally as opposed to the words of Mishlei, which can be interpreted as mishalim, as metaphors, as allegories. Al-Kain, lo notziyenu midei pshuto. Accordingly, we will not remove it from its pshat meaning so long as the pshat does not contradict common sense. Is there any point at which we look at a text and we say, looking at the text, this text calls for a metaphorical or an allegorical understanding? Ibn Ezra says, yes, there is a place where you do that, and that is where the literal translation contradicts common sense. And he's about to give you an example. For example, in the verse, Umaltem et orlat levavchem, you shall circumcise the foreskin of your heart. The meaning of which we logically have to adjust. We do not think that there's a mitzvah for people to perform open heart surgery on themselves or on their children and look for the heart and try to find the foreskin that is on the heart. It's obvious in that context there. It means you people are behaving in a hard-hearted manner as if there is this hard covering on your hearts, and you should get rid of that hard covering on your hearts. And logically, we know, common sense tells us that nobody is asking us to perform open heart surgery, so that's why we do that. However, the rule in the methodology of interpreting the text of the Torah is that we always offer the literal interpretation, except when logic forces us not to do this. What has happened between 1142 and 1153? Look, a lot of things could have happened between 1142 and 1153, but one thing that we know for sure that happened is that Ibn Ezra left Italy and came to northern France, and he was living in the place where Rashbam was thriving and teaching and writing. And whether he knew or not that Rashbam had offered this interpretation, he's presumably hearing people on the streets of northern France, in the shuls of northern France, offering this interpretation, which he wrote about in a calm kind of manner in 1142. And then he shows up in northern France in 1153, and I'm guessing that now he's hearing people taking that interpretation seriously, and he now comes up with this methodological argument about why one should not be accepting an interpretation like that of the biblical text. Ibn Ezra talks about metaphor and allegory frequently in his works. In fact, he wrote a very long excursus on the topic of allegorical kind of interpretation in his introduction to his Torah commentary. This is actually the introduction to his first version of the Torah commentary. He wrote this in Italy. So he's always felt this way. We'll see how he feels about allegory and allegorical interpretations of the biblical text. And I assume that many of you will be able to figure out right away, even before I say what I'm going to say here, why it is that Ibn Ezra is so perturbed about allegory and metaphor. The structure of Ibn Ezra's introduction to his Torah commentary says there are five kinds of Torah commentaries, and here's type number one, and this is what's wrong with that. Type number two, what's wrong with that? Type number three, what's wrong with that? Four, what's wrong with that? Type number five, mine, that's the right kind of Torah commentary. So type number three, he uses a kind of metaphor in his writing about this subject. The metaphor is that there's truth is in the middle of a circle. And there are some people who are, somewhere inside of that circle as they're trying to find the truth of the biblical text. And there are other people that are in total darkness, and that it's beyond the circumference, that, that there's the truth is in the middle of the circle, and there's the circumference of the circle. And there are these people out there who are offering interpretations of the Torah that are so far off that they are beyond the circumference. These are the people who invent secret allegorical meanings for all texts. You can probably see those who can follow the Hebrew see that he's writing this in what we would not quite call poetry, but he's writing it in what people generally call rhymed prose. They invent secret allegorical meanings for all the texts, and who believe that all the laws of the Torah are riddles. I'm not going to refute them at length. They're fools. Why should I get involved with them? Who is he talking about? The simplest understanding is that he is upset here about Christian allegorical interpretation of the Bible. And that was very common, that Christians would look at the laws in the Torah and would say that these laws are contain truth within them, but they were not meant to be taken on a literal level, and they should be understood allegorically or metaphorically. Bilti b'davar echad tzadku, asher kol davar mitzvah ktana u'gdola b'kaf mosnei halev tiyeh shgula. There's only one thing that they're right about, which is that every mitzvah, large or small, has to be weighed by the scales of reason. That's what you have to do. You have to have an ad hoc judgment about every mitzvah. To have a methodology that says that all of the laws of the Torah are to be understood as having some allegorical or metaphorical kind of meaning, that's bad methodology. But to analyze them one by one and to use reason, mosnei halev, the scales of your heart, which means the scales of your mind, and that's the tool that you're supposed to be using. If reason rejects something, if you find something in the Torah that just doesn't make sense, and he's going to give, in the continuation, he's going to give his favorite example of circumcising the foreskin of the heart. That's something that we all understand is not logical to interpret that literally, and or if it contradicts sensory data, bahargashot yidbar, that it becomes clear through the senses, then we look for an allegorical meaning, and then this medieval philosopher who really believes in reason, he says, for reason is the basis of everything. The Torah was not given to those who lack reason, for the intermediary between people and God is the brain. Hamalach, I love this line here, Hamalach bein Adam uvein Elohav hu sichlo. The thing that allows me to have a relationship with God is the very, very full. You could tell that we were dealing here with a philosopher, not with a mystic, and not with some person who's looking for spiritual experiences. We're dealing with a philosopher who feels that which helps us connect with God is our seichel. That's what we hear God speaking to us through our seichel. We communicate with God through our seichel. So that. We're allowed to use the tool of our seichel when we're analyzing the Torah. But anything that reason does not contradict, we will interpret in its plain meaning. We'll keep it as it is, and we'll believe that that's its true meaning. And now, at the end, he realizes that actually there is the possibility that a text could have both an abstract meaning and a concrete meaning at the same time. It's true, even though there are areas in which both the physical and the conceptual are true, like the idea of circumcision of the flesh and of the heart's foreskin. So when one speaks about circumcision, one can be speaking about the physical circumcision of the foreskin, of the male organ, or one can be speaking about circumcision in an abstract manner. And that's fine. And you don't have to choose between those two options. You can have this concept of circumcision that's true both on the conceptual level and on the physical level. Then he says, to finish the safin, yesh ish lo yachilu zerayonav, imu chacham yifkach et einav. People who don't understand this should, if they are wise, just open up your eyes. Ki yimtza בתולדות רבים נוצרים כנחיריים והלשון והרגליים לשני דברים. Just take a look at nature. In nature, we find many things that were created for two purposes. Our nostrils are useful for breathing air in and for breathing air out, and perhaps for other purposes, for blowing your nose. The tongue is useful. We speak using the tongue. There are many letters that you simply can't pronounce unless you've got a tongue. And of course, the tongue is useful for tasting food. The legs are good for standing, good for walking, good for kicking a soccer ball. So you look at something that was created in nature and you see that it has more than one purpose. And so you should be willing to accept that idea that sometime there will be things in the Torah that will have an abstract meaning and have a physical meaning. And there is no problem with that. Who is Ibn Ezra upset about here? Is he upset about Christian interpretation of the Bible? Very possibly the case. Or is he upset about the interpretation that Rashbam offered here that he just discovered when he showed up there in northern France in the late 1140s or the beginning of the 1150s? Also possible. We will look at one more text today, and that is from this week's Torah portion. The end of the parsha, when God is speaking to Aharon and Miriam and says to them, "Hear these my words. When a prophet of the Lord arises among you, I make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is trusted throughout my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth. Pe el pe adaber bo umare velo vechidot. Plainly and not in riddles." When God says to Aaron and Miriam, when I speak to Moshe, I'm speaking to him plainly and I'm not speaking in riddles. And he beholds the likeness of the Lord. "How then did you not shrink from speaking against my servant Moshe?" is what God says to Aaron and Miriam. A few years after Ibn Ezra and Rashbam, in the late 12th century in northern France, Rabbi Yosef Bechorshor is writing his commentary on this section from this week's Torah portion. He quotes the verse and he says, "Uvechan nishberu zeroam shel umot ha'olam shomrim ma she'amar Moshe Rabbeinu allegoria him." Here the arms of the Gentiles are broken. They say that everything that Moses wrote is to be understood as allegoria. He writes out the word, for those who can see the Hebrew, he writes out the word allegoria in Hebrew, in Hebrew letters. But when God says to Aaron and Moshe that I speak to Moshe plainly, the lo bechidot, without any riddles, that means there's no allegories that have to be explained in the Torah. So Bechorshor begins this comment by making it clear that he's upset about allegorical interpretation of the Torah because he thinks that that's something that Christians do. But then he goes on and says, "Gam mibnei amenu shamati shemefakim al tefillin umezozot בכיסוי הדם שאומרים והיה לאות על ידך ותודפו בין עיניך וכתבתם זו ביתך ומשעריך שהוא כמו סימני כחותם על ליבך כחותם על זרועך." I've also heard some of our people casting aspersions about tefillin and mezuzah and covering the blood of a slaughtered animal. They say that the verse, "It shall be a sign on your arm and a decoration between your eyes," should be understood allegorically, like the verse, "Place me as a locket on your heart," which just means always remember me, and doesn't refer to a literal sign on the arm or on the heart. So all these verses are not references to tefillin or mezuzah. Just let me make it clear. We have Rashbam's controversial comment here about this verse that is generally understood as being about tefillin. We don't have anything controversial written by Rashbam about mezuzah or about kisui hadam, but the possibility that once Rashbam offered this interpretation in the first half of the 12th century in northern France, then started the ball started rolling among other Jews there, and other Jews started to interpret the text this way, and Bechorshor is upset about this. So also these verses are not references to tefillin or mezuzah. About this, Bechorshor says, Oy lahem me'elbona shel Torah. Woe to them for their insult of Torah. They will yet be called to account for this. That's insulting to the Torah to offer these kind of metaphorical interpretations. In his commentary on Sefer Devarim on Deuteronomy, Bechorshor picks up this point again and writes, those commentators who say that this verse is like, place me as a locket on your heart and is not about tefillin are wrong and misleading. They interpret the Torah in a manner that does not accord with halacha. Marim panim batorah shelo kahalacha, which can a good understanding of that phrase, laharot panim batorah shelo kahalacha, means explaining words of the Torah in a way that does not conform to what halacha, to what Jewish law says. And then he makes an interesting argument here. Why did they not pay attention to what the Talmudic rabbis did? The Talmudic rabbis knew how to prove from the Torah that a reptile is kosher, but you will never find any one of them removing even one mitzvah from the Torah. There's this kind of anti-intellectual point here. The Talmudic rabbis were very smart, and you often find the statements about rabbis who were smart enough that they could come up with theoretical arguments about why a reptile is actually kosher when actually it is not kosher. They could build the argument. So they knew about these, they knew how to do this. But when they argued, they only argued about details of the law. You will never find them, the classical rabbis, uprooting an entire mitzvah. So you know that they exercised restraint. They knew how to do this exercise of finding new interpretations of biblical texts, but they refrained from doing it. But these contemporary Bible commentators remove mitzvot through their pshat interpretations. May God forgive them. Share lehu maraihu. That phrase, share lehu maraihu, is a Talmudic phrase that appears a number of times. Curiously, a Jew in Toronto, I assume that some of you Torontonians know, Dr. Tibor Judah once pointed out to me that the rabbi in the Talmud who most often says, Share lehu maraihu, is Rav Yosef. And here, this is Rav Yosef Bechorshor in the 12th century, also using that phrase, Share lehu maraihu. It's a phrase that's used by one rabbi when disagreeing with another rabbi. In all the contexts, in the Talmud, whenever anybody uses the phrase "shara lehu maraihu," why am I making this point? Because some people try to argue that Bechorshor here has found out about the Karaites and is upset about Karaite biblical interpretation, and I just find it really unlikely that he would be using a soft phrase like this, "shara lehu maraihu." May God forgive them for offering this interpretation. And I'll just show you, just to finish off the class, I'll show you that same phrase, may God forgive them, is used about Rashbam in another context by his brother, by Rabbeinu Tam, in his introduction to his halachic work called Sefer HaYashar. Rabbeinu Tam teaches us something about how Rashi emended texts, Talmudic texts, and how Rashbam emended Talmudic texts. I'll read this in English just the same time. When Rabbi Shlomo, Rashi, emended the text of the Talmud, he proposed the emendation in his commentary, but he didn't change the Talmudic text. If Rashi had a copy of the Talmudic text, then he didn't. He thought that there was an error there. He wrote a marginal comment on the side suggesting a correction of the text. His followers, he said, Nebuch, those followers didn't follow his methodology. They did change the Talmudic text to conform to Rashi's suggestions, something that he never wanted done. Serious Talmud students know all the time that, you know, it's often you see Rashi says, Achi Garsinan, here's the proper way to read the text. And then you look at the Talmud sitting in front of you, and that's the way the text reads. And then you're saying, what reading did Rashi have there that he didn't like? And if you're using standard Vilna Talmud, very often you don't know. But Rabbeinu Tam says that when Rashi used to correct his text to the Talmud, he only did it in the margin, and he had no idea that anybody would come and actually correct the Talmudic phrase, the Talmudic text itself. And then Rabbeinu Tam goes on and says, "V'share le mare le Rabbeinu Shmuel." And I hope that God will forgive my brother Shmuel, Rabbeinu Shmuel, who offers 20 times as many emendations as were offered by Rashi. And not only that, when Rashbam offers an emendation of the Talmud, he erases the manuscript reading and he substitutes his own conjectural emendation. And I know he does this because of his great intelligence and because of his deep pilpul. I have a lot of respect for my older brother Rashbam, but he's doing the wrong thing here. He's emending the text of the Talmud too much. But share le mare. So I think that this kind of criticism here, the share le mare criticism, is something that two people younger than Rashbam are saying. When they accuse him, we hope that God will forgive him for the methodological errors that he does. And those methodological errors are a sign, of course, of his great intelligence. It's funny, both Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor is talking about the intelligence that's required in order to come up with these interpretations. And Rabbeinu Tam says the same thing. I know that he often has really strong arguments for his conjectural emendations to the Talmudic text, but still, you don't do this. This is not the right methodology in dealing with the text. So we have seen here an example of Rashbam being willing to offer an allegorical, a non-literal understanding of a biblical verse, and how upset it seems the two of his younger contemporaries became about this, both his younger brother and Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, who may have even been a student of his. People aren't certain. And so this is our first session about allegory and metaphor in interpretation of biblical texts, and we will continue with this topic next week. And now I'll stop sharing the screen and we can take a look at the chat. Next Tim trip to Western Canada, good idea. Okay. Would you call Rashbam an iconoclast, BS? Yes, I would. And I also think that Rashbam got his jollies by being an iconoclast. I think that he enjoyed very much being an iconoclast. And do I see myself as an iconoclast? No, I don't. I try not to see myself as being an iconoclast. But I don't think I'm as smart as Rashbam was and as creative as Rashbam was. But I think that he got his jollies from taking positions that he knew would bother people. And maybe some other time I can develop that argument some more. Maybe Rashbam only comments on 13.9 because it is so out of place, so he needs a metaphorical interpretation. Why did he even have them leave in the first Perush if he says, but toch kadei dibur that is canceled? Very good comments, Ellen. Why do you do it? Is he trying to hint that he thinks that there's something to that, even though it was canceled? Is it possible that Rashbam thinks otherwise, thinks differently about all the other verses that mention what's understood as tefillin? Maybe. Phil, wonderful to see you, Phil. Is the trustworthiness possibly in the eyes of the beholder? Tefillin that cannot be seen cannot be trusted. That's very true. If you can't see the tefillin, it's hard to know. Are they kosher tefillin or not? Very true. Gershon says, ideas identification of seichel as a malach is a metaphor that Rambam uses when he writes in the Moreh that a Navi hears God's words because of angelic transmission. Very good, Gershon. And of course, we all know that Rambam lived a number of years after Ibn Ezra. And so he's using a metaphor. There's a lot of discussion about whether Rambam saw Ibn Ezra's commentary on the Torah. There's a letter attributed to Rambam that he wrote. He allegedly wrote it to his son, but it has been proven by scholars that it's a forgery, that Rambam never wrote that letter. But in a letter that he had allegedly written to his son, it said that you shouldn't study anybody's Torah commentary except for Ibn Ezra's. Rabbi Professor Tversky wrote about this subject and came to the conclusion, offered some very good proofs that it seems pretty likely that Rambam did know Ibn Ezra's commentary on the Torah, so he could have picked up this this idea from him. Also, did Rashbam suggest some other verse for deriving tefillin? Steve asked. He didn't, but there are three other verses. Another one in the continuation of Exodus chapter 13, and two verses in Deuteronomy. And as I said, some people say Rashbam must have seen them literally because there the action is ukshartam lo'otayadach. You should tie them. But of course, if a noun can be allegorized, I think a verb can be allegorized also. It's not such a strong argument. Zev says when God says he speaks directly to Moshe, he mentions my household. How do Chazal explain that phrase? Zev, I'm not sure, but I think that it's generally understood to mean those who are close to me. Among those who are close to God, some are closer than others, and Moshe is closer than everybody else. That's how that's how I think that phrase is generally understood. That seems to be the chat. If anybody wants to unmute themselves and ask anything right now, feel free. We still have 3 minutes left.
Thank you. If I may, can I ask what's to me a very simple question, but I don't know people who've talked about it. I'm sure I just must be missing something. Pel pe daber bo. Okay, that's very nice. This week's parsha. Kilo yera hadam. How do you resolve those two verses?
So Rabbi Kalman is pointing out that there's plenty of anthropomorphic language about God. So how do we deal with a phrase like this? It is funny, I would say, Rabbi Kelman, that, you know, obviously you have to allegorize the phrase pe'el pe', you know, in this.
It's a blatant contradiction.
Yes, yeah.
Even if you allegorize it. I mean, I understand. I'm just curious. I haven't seen much discussion about this. I imagine some people have discussed. I'm just not aware. And
right.
I was wondering if, you know. You can,
I don't know off the top of my head, but it's a great question.
Yes. All right. If anybody knows, please let us know. Me tell me deino yoter mi kulam, you know, so.
That is definitely true. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Anybody else would like to unmute themselves, ask a question? That's fine. Just while you're doing that, this evening's shiur will be slightly different. Moshe Zuckel of shiur in the Haftorah. The Haftorah for Parsha Balocha is the same one as on Shabbos Chanukah. So since he already spoke about that, you can listen to the Shabbos Chanukah. He asked if it was okay, and of course it's okay. He's going to give a shiur tonight on prophecy in general, but it's sort of along this what we're saying. What does it mean to be a prophet? How does one become a prophet? So that's our quote-unquote Haftarah share of the week this evening at 8 o'clock by Moshe Sokolov. So if you haven't been joining all year, even though every week of course independent, every Haftarah is independent, but tonight might be a good chance, unless you're asleep in Israel at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I hope, please God,
that people can now sleep through the night. That's not
nothing to laugh about.
Correct. Not always taken for granted. All right. Yes. But anyways, okay. Want to thank you, Dr. Lakshin. Thank you very much. If any last minute questions, and we look forward to seeing you next week. And everybody should be well and be healthy. And we should hear only good news and good things.
Amen.
Okay. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
And more about allegory next week.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Thank you. Good. Thank you.